This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Okay, we'll get started. Hello and welcome to this panel, which is called Between Two Fires, Left Perspectives on the War in Ukraine. My name is Bob Capistrano, and I'm the president of the Daniel Singer Foundation, which is sponsoring this panel. The foundation was formed 25 years ago to honor the late longtime European correspondent of The Nation, Daniel Singer, by awarding prizes to authors of published essays which are written in the democratic, socialist, and sort of people power tradition of Daniel Singer. His thoughts were sort of exemplified in a couple of books that are still available. Probably the most famous one is Prelude to Revolution, which was about the May-June uprising in France in 1968. And another one was The Road to Gdansk, which was about the shipyard workers in the Solidarity Movement in Poland in the 1980s, which sort of crystallized what he was interested in, which was the mobilization of people in their own interests. Today's panel focuses on Ukraine's assertion of self-determination in the face of Russia's invasion and NATO encroachment. This year's prize has gone to Taras Bilus, author of The War in, the name of the essay is The War in Ukraine, International Security, and the Left. And this is Taras, who is appearing from Eastern Ukraine right now, where he's actually serving in the Ukrainian Armed Forces. So we're really glad that he was able to appear with us. Also with us are Olena Lyubchenko, who wrote an essay called On the Frontiers of Whiteness, which was one of the runner-up prizes that the Singer Foundation gave out. And who is a PhD candidate in political science at York University in Toronto. And our second speaker is Vladimir Shenko, who is the second speaker from the far left, who, let's see. Yeah, well, far left, maybe. He teaches at the Free University in Berlin. His most recent book was entitled Towards the Abyss. It's on the table in the bookstore section. In moderating this session is Susie Weissman, who is a professor of politics at St. Mary's College, or retired professor of politics at St. Mary's College in Moraga, California, and who is the host of a couple of series. One is the long-running KPFK series called Beneath the Surface, and also the Jacobin blog. And also, I should say that she wrote a book called Victor Surge, A Political Biography, which, you know, another one of the heroes of the left. And she'll be moderating this panel, and so I'm just going to turn it over to Susie. Vladimir can see you, right?
Yeah, he can see. Thank you, Bob. And probably this is a little bit, you know, superfluous to have two intros, but I've got an intro as well to the panel. I want to thank Bob. Thank all the members of the Daniel Singer panel, Price Foundation for putting this panel together, and to Bob for his excellent framing, from which I'm going to borrow liberally. And thanks also to the Socialism Conference for the tech team for their help, and to Dennis Bondar, who agreed at the very last second, essentially, to translate for prize winner Taras Bilis. And we're very fortunate to have our panelists with us, our prize winners with us, and they're all going to put forward their analyses and arguments about Russia's war in Ukraine, now in its third year, a brutal, destructive disaster causing human suffering and economic devastation on an unthinkable scale. It's a shock to the world system with gigantic global consequences. And it's no exaggeration to say that this war changed the trajectory of the 21st century. It also changed Russia internally. Putin's repression of any form of dissent, silencing all critics, has escalated tremendously, resulting in arrests and long prison sentences on the flimsiest and often the most absurd charges. You could get detained in Russia for going out wearing blue jeans and a yellow shirt, Ukraine's flag's colors, or for writing or uttering the words "Нет война" or "No war," and so much more, as we all know. And Russia's war on Ukraine has also deepened divisions among the international left, especially in the United States and the UK. And this is the point that Taras Bilis has addressed to great effect. Each of our panelists' essays address in one way or another the question of who defines the meaning of and shapes the perceptions about both the war and Ukrainian self-determination. We've asked our panelists to summarize their arguments that they made in their winning essays and to evaluate their analysis 2 years after the invasion, at a point when the war is expanding into Russia, Kursk, and other former Soviet republics, the Baltics are being threatened. We'll hear first from Taras Bilis, and another little bit, if you'll put up with me. He's the winner of this year's Daniel Singer Prize. His essay, as Bob said, is "The War in Ukraine, International Security, and the Left." It was published in Silne or Commons and by New Politics, a magazine in the United States. Taras is from Luhansk and lives in Kyiv. He writes that the 2014 events in Ukraine pushed him in the opposite direction of most Ukrainians. It killed nationalism in him and pushed him to the left and made him want to fight for a better future, not just for his own nation, but for humanity. He's an historian, journalist, and activist in Socialny Ruch, or the socialist movement, social movement, and an editor of Commons. And in the beginning months of the war, he took on the Western left very effectively, laying out the case for supporting Ukraine against Russia's invasion in a series of articles that include a letter to the Western left from Kyiv, that was in February, self-determination in the war in Ukraine in April, and "I'm a Ukrainian socialist, here's why I resist the Russian invasion," and then, of course, the winning essay, "War in Ukraine, International Security and the Left." And these pieces, I just want to say before we give it over to Taras, is that these pieces build on each other, and they make a powerful case for supporting Ukraine against Russia's invasion. In his winning essay, Taras polemicizes against Western leftists who see the war primarily as a clash between NATO expansionism and Russia's defensive interests, and in so doing, deny Ukraine's right of self-determination, if not its very right to exist. He challenges those leftists who characterize the conflict as a proxy war between Russia and NATO, shifting the responsibility for the invasion from Russia to the West, and thereby ignoring Ukrainians in the process. And he literally pleads for international solidarity. As a Ukrainian socialist internationalist, he also writes that he detests wars, but he writes that the basic premise of self-determination justifies resistance to Putin's brutal invasion. And I'm sure Taras is going to tell you, but he decided to join the Territorial Defense Force, and he is still serving in the Ukraine Armed Forces. And he says, and this is important, that there are other socialists and anarchists who have joined Ukraine's armed forces and have no illusions about who they're defending or why they're defending Ukraine's far from perfect democracy, but it's worth protecting from Putin's para-fascist regime. And finally, I should just note that as the prize winner, Taras generously donated the entirety of his prize to the Solidarity Collective, which collects funds for anti-capitalist volunteers in the armed forces of Ukraine and territorial defense. So we turn now to Taras. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, everyone, and thanks for gathering here today. First of all, I would like to thank the Daniel Stinner Foundation for the award. It's a great honor for me, and also for the opportunity to speak here. Unfortunately, I could not make it in person. I'm currently in the north of the Kharkiv region, and my commander refused to give me a leave. And I am also grateful to the foundation for agreeing to transfer the money to the Solidarity Collectives, to which I donated my award. In the first month of the Russian invasion, I wrote a series of articles, mostly critical of the Western world's response to the war. Honestly, I don't like those texts much, and now they were written in a hurry under difficult circumstances, and I did not have enough time to think everything. So. But I still think that in that situation, it was better to write what I wrote than to remain silent. Because the reaction of many among the international left was mostly disappointing. I understand that it was unusual for many of the left when the aggressor is not the West, but it should be obviously that in this situation the response should be radically different. And the selective repetition of century-old slogans can't be the answer, especially if we forget that 100 years ago revolutionaries called for a democratic peace without annexations, while now many anti-war left implicitly call for forcing the victim of aggression to accept the annexation. It's important to note that not all radical left reached in this way. Significant part supported the Ukrainian resistance, and I am grateful. Very grateful for that. Anyway, my article was on international security, which won this award. So I will focus on that topic. I will start with a personal story. When I was a student, one of my least favorite and least interesting courses was war history. I was not interested in the army, international security, weapons, and so on. The history of political movements and revolution interested me much more. But then, 10 years ago, the war came to my native region, Donbas. And already for 10 years, my hometown has been on the other side of the front line. And it was life itself that forced me to take an interest in war and in the international security. So I'm not an expert on this topic, but I think that the left's analysis on these issues is mostly very weak, and the agenda on this issue is even worse. And I think one of the main reasons for this is that most leftists don't live in countries that have been invaded or even threatened by the invasion of another country's army. Also, it must be admitted that the Ukrainian left before the invasion also paid not enough attention to these issues, despite that our situation was radically different. Shortly after the declaration of independence, Ukraine found itself between two fires. The United States and Russia jointly forced Ukraine to hand over nuclear weapons to Russia. US pressure in this matter was crucial. Ukraine demanded reliable security guarantees in exchange for nuclear weapons, but the US refused to make serious commitments. This year, by the way, is 30 years since the Budapest Memorandum was signed. After all, Russia invaded a country that once gave Russia its nuclear weapons in exchange for respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. And it seems for me that the international left still doesn't understand the impact of this fact on the nuclear security. Even then, Ukraine found itself in a very vulnerable position because in the current world, the real security against the invasion is actually provided by the nuclear weapons or military alliances with nuclear states. And the Russian invasion has reinforced this, and all nuclear powers are now upgrading their arsenals. And what is the left's answer to this? Mostly it's just calling for the dissolution of military alliances. Of course, military alliances led by imperialist states are a bad instrument, but without an effective new international security architecture, the dissolution of current military alliances will mean that small countries will have to rely more on their armed forces to protect themselves and therefore increase defense spending. This is actually what Trump mean when he is talking about the withdrawal of the United States from NATO. And right-wing populists want states to withdraw from mutual obligations and return to a world where each country pursues its own interests unfettered by restrictions. The left should raise the call for extending the commitment to defense to the entire world. What the agenda might look like is matter for discussion. In the first month of the invasion, I wrote about the UN reform. And I understand how many problems are with this. But in the past 2 years, I have not seen anyone offer an alternative. And in general, I see few discussion about this. But what is important, the victims of various armed conflicts in the world have different enemies and aliases. They are different they are victims of different imperialisms, and geopolitical fault lines often divide us. But one of the things we have in common is that we suffer from the inefficiency of international organizations, from the UN to the Red Cross. And for example, cases against Russia and Israel in international courts showed that Ukrainian, Palestinians and other peoples are interested in reforming this and other international organizations. And this is something around which there could be a dialogue and cooperation between the victims of competing imperialisms. This is where Ukraine participants could be important, and where the international world could positively influence the situation. Building bridges between Ukraine and other contexts, but not in the discussions about arms supplies, which we have almost no influence on, but in action aimed at specific issues such as safety of nuclear-powered plants and humanitarian issues and international organizations. And unfortunately, it seems for me that this opportunity has already been missed. Thank you for attention.
No, thank you, Taras. Thanks for that. Our next speaker is, well, both of our next two panelists received the runners-up Daniel Singer Prize for their essays. This year we received so many prize entries, and so many of them were so good that we decided for the very first time, the foundation, that we would award a prize to the close seconds. And we have both of them here today. Olena Lyubchenko will speak next. Her essay was published in Left East, and it's called On the Frontier of Whiteness, Expropriation, War, and Social Reproduction in Ukraine. And there you go. Olena is a PhD candidate, as Bob said, at in politics at York University in Toronto, and she's an editor as well of Left East. Her family is from Mariupol. Using the prism of race and class and gender, Olena's essay notes the way Western elites welcomed displaced Ukrainians at war into the arms of the white world, in contrast to its treatment of other war refugees, including Palestinians, all the while happy to rely on Ukrainian refugees, primarily women, in low-paid domestic or service work and ignoring the continuing repression by the white government within Ukraine. So I'm going to turn it over to Olena.
Can everyone hear me? Yeah? Okay, so first I want to thank my comrades at Left East who encouraged me to write this piece that I titled On the Frontier of Whiteness, Expropriation, War, and Social Reproduction in Ukraine. This prize is really won by the Left East Collective. It's a great honor because Left East has pushed so much critical thinking on the Eastern European post-Soviet world. And I'm in good company with Volodymyr Yushchenko, from whom I continue to learn, and with Taras Bilous, whose piece sparked much debate. A few of the pieces sparked much debate and forced us to sharpen our own arguments. And so, of course, big thanks to the Daniel Singer Prize for the award and for organizing this discussion today, and the social reproduction work of bringing us here, all the care, and to all of you who are joining us this afternoon. Today, I was asked to answer this question, who defines the meaning of and shapes perspectives about the war in Ukraine and Ukraine's self-determination. And as I was flying in, descending into Chicago, I was like, my quick and simple answer might be like BlackRock. Maybe BlackRock defines Ukraine's self-determination in the near future, you know? And I'll come back to that in a few minutes. But first, let me say a few words about my piece. It was really motivated by two things. My rage against at the theatrics of European and North American sympathies for Ukrainians, against a background of colonial violence elsewhere, and against decades of expropriation of Ukrainian working class people, mothers, grandmothers, children. And second, I was motivated to try to understand the changing position of Ukraine within global capitalism and the patterns of production and social reproduction as it pertains to the post-Soviet states in particular and its working class people. You know, Ruthie Gilmore famously says that there is no capitalism that is not racial. And I think that's also true for the post-Soviet world, right? Post-Soviet countries. But what does it mean in particular in the context of post-Soviet Ukraine? If you recall, as fleeing Ukrainian women with children were welcomed in Europe, right, while undeserving others were barred from entry, we were told, I was told, by like random people on the street, you know, that Ukraine is fighting a European war and Ukraine is defending Europe. Ukrainian resistance against Russian aggression was celebrated, but of course popular resistance elsewhere was deemed terrorist, right, at best. And I thought that the emerging idea of Ukrainianness was really beginning to be equated with Europeanness, and Ukraine's sovereignty and self-determination were sold to us as bound up with incorporation into fortress Europe, right? And the making of the Ukrainian nation as white and European. Yes, like we all saw that. We saw the discrepancy in treatment and so on. But I think that there is a deeper political economic significance. I think that Ukraine's sovereignty and self-determination were also importantly bound up with what has been called, in quotation marks, decommunization. In Ukraine, as in other post-Soviet and Eastern European countries, right, neoliberalism arrived in the form of shock therapy reforms. And since the post-Soviet collapse, Ukraine, among other post-socialist, post-Soviet, okay, countries, is kind of placed on the trajectory to progress, a transition from what is called a Homo Sovieticus, which is like the Soviet man, to a civilized European middle-class white subject. And economically, this never-ending transition takes the shape of free market neoliberal reforms. And so, you know, it's really an unequal access to whiteness, a precarious access to whiteness that can be taken away, you know, disciplined through these decommunization social and economic reforms, significant cuts to public spending, horrible labor laws, dispossessive IMF reforms, energy policies, and these have become push factors for labor migration to the West and remittance dependence, right? And I argued in the piece that this is, and it continues to be, a gendered process generating a disciplined workforce at home and a reserve army of precarious, gendered, cheap white migrant labor headed for the EU and now also Canada and the United States to a lesser degree. And especially since 2014, Ukraine's militarization has been intimately linked to austerity measures, increasing austerity measures, displacing the burdens of resisting Russian aggression and preparing for a very, by the way, highly unequal and who knows when process of Euro-Atlantic integration. Displacing these burdens onto households and especially women and gendered labor in the home, right? But more than that, this kind of whiteness that I call, you know, it's whiteness, cheap whiteness, forms not really a dichotomy of not of white, not white, but rather a kind of gradient. Because as Polish women go to work in German households, or in the UK, you know, a lot of the time, Ukrainian women come in to replace them in Poland, in Polish households. And they compete to clean toilets for German women, you know, with Syrian women. They compete for those positions, and they are kind of instrumentalized to lower labor costs. And I would argue that Western economies gain by intensifying labor competition, right, and further devaluing workers from the global South as the racialized others. Since 2020, like, I mean, there have been, remittances have made up such a huge, you know, component of Ukraine's economy. I have so many numbers, I don't need to tell them. But really, especially since 2014 and then, you know, during COVID. And in addition to the case of feminized migrant labor, my article also looked at the growth of the commercial surrogacy industry in Ukraine. Also, really, its growth since 2014, as many surrogacy workers are from the Donbas region. So just like migrant labor, Ukraine's assisted reproduction technologies industry, or what is called reprotourism, is also deeply dependent on transnational networks, right, class and racialization, quite literally oriented towards the reproduction of white European babies by poor white social reproductive laborers in Ukraine. And the surrogacy industry in Ukraine really positions itself as a more competitive, in contrast to surrogacy industries in India or Thailand, in large part due to whiteness and Europeanness, so-called, of its workers, okay? So with these two examples of reproductive labor for the EU, I argued that the idea, and I continue to think this way, that the idea that Ukraine's return to Europe is based on self-determination, like this return to Europe, really obfuscates how Europe's own reproduction has been underpinned by dispossessive economic reforms in Eastern Europe, including Ukraine, and the global South, and is shaped by racial citizenship and gendered violence, okay? So, on the frontier of whiteness, 2.5 years later now, I dare say that I am convinced that since I wrote this piece in April 2022, 2.5 years since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, my arguments, I believe have been confirmed. And that's really an understatement. I think they have been materially substantiated by three further developments, which is the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine, that has become a neoliberal industry in the making, you know, it's open-ended. Russia's military Keynesianism, what has been called Russia's military Keynesianism, and I like to call it militarization and financialization of social reproduction. And of course, third is the genocide in Palestine. These three really confirm, I think, this thesis on the frontier of whiteness of Ukraine. And I'll just briefly speak about the third, the Palestine, and then move on to Ukraine's neoliberal reconstruction. So, you know, the UN coordinated appeal for Ukraine was 80% funded, while Afghanistan was only 38% funded, Yemen 27%, and Sudan 20%. There's like a huge discrepancy. The genocide in Gaza by the Israeli state has exposed what so many have called the double standards of the rules-based order, right? You know, you all probably have attended the keynote, the beautiful plenary on Friday on Palestine. It was very moving. It addressed everything. Like, I don't need to repeat the horror of the experience. So, you know, many have pointed out the double standards of Western sympathies, these double standards, Ukraine versus Palestine, okay. But I think what I want to argue today is that this is not really double standards. I suggest that we cannot not see Ukraine in light of Palestine, because it is not double standards, but both cases are kind of one part of one logic. You know, the war in Ukraine has emboldened this logic, and I think it's this revival of the legitimacy of the so-called rules-based order, but one that really is based on absence of rules for some, deeply rooted in colonial racial capitalism. And And, you know, this is very difficult to do, but I think we must sit with the following fact with honesty. For me, you know, sometimes I go to sleep and I think about this at night, that the weapons that are going to Ukraine to fight for Ukraine's self-determination are also the weapons that are killing Palestinian children, and it's the same military-industrial complex. Lockheed Martin's CEO, he told investors that he expects that the fiscal 2025 presidential budget requests and additive supplemental funding will provide, quote, a strong underpinning for future growth over the next several years for their company, end quote. So I think, yes, I mean, Palestinian and Ukrainian children deserve not just a ceasefire or peace, a peace that is only like based on status quo or return to normal, in very different contexts, return to dispossession and expropriation that was there before, even though the mothers are begging even for this kind of end to the fire, right? Open fire. But what we want is, of course, the liberation from the structural violence and dispossession in the first place. So now in terms of Ukraine, liberation from the dispossession is nowhere near, I think. It's really not on the horizon. Already in April, just 2 months after Russia's invasion, the Zelensky government announced its recovery and reconstruction plan for Ukraine. You know, this is 2 months after Russia's invasion. The war is ongoing and they're already recovering. I don't know. It has been dubbed as the Green Marshall Plan, by the way, a reference to the great moral, right, and economic project against, you know, after the fascist defeat in the Second World War. But this time, there's this nod to the green transition, right? So let's see what is this green transition for Ukraine. The original Marshall Plan, of course, was implemented in the context of comprehensive Soviet social settlement, you know, state intervention, social citizenship, some kind of promise of social citizenship. But now, today, Ukraine's reconstruction is really occurring in the context of late neoliberalism, right? And since July 2022, Ukraine's reconstruction has emerged as a new global neoliberal industry. The damage caused by Russia's invasion, and the Zelensky government's labor and social policy reforms, which have reduced, you know, social costs, right? They have really created a conducive environment and opportunity for a new wave of capital accumulation in Ukraine. The reconstruction industry kind of gathers pace at a time of great uncertainty now. The war in Ukraine is reaching, some would say it's reaching an impasse, continuing to lose territory, social despair, so much resistance against forced mobilization. Now these laws are reaching people, you know, in other countries outside of Ukraine, and the debt service obligations are coming due, so it's difficult, and the U.S. elections. And the World Bank says that the reconstruction industry will exceed for almost $490 billion U.S. dollars, right, over the next decade. And of course, it will shift the costs associated with this reconstruction onto Ukrainian households, as was hopefully clear from the first part of my presentation. But the underexamined and perhaps the most important aspect of Ukraine's post-war reconstruction, and this is where my research has gone since, is the reconfiguration of the post-Soviet state as a de-risking entity for primarily, predominantly foreign finance capital, invited to finance, reconstruct, and manage Ukraine's public infrastructure, resources, and services. And I don't have much time to address this, but just to highlight just the few contours of this mess. So among welfare and land of particular importance is Ukraine's energy sector, especially devastated by Russia's attacks, right? Now it's prime opportunity for capital accumulation. It's listed as priority number 4 in the Zelensky recovery plan, highly investable area, you know, key highly investable area. And of course, I have several questions, like, well, does its investability have to do with Ukraine's kind of ironic competitive advantage? First, like, the war, making it competitive, you know. You have to destroy in order to rebuild, to invest and make money. So that's okay. That we have, you know. And then the second, and I think that's an important component of this investability, is the leftovers of Soviet-era state capacity in terms of public infrastructure and low energy prices. And that's what I'm really interested in looking at. So will domestic public resources, or whatever is left of them, be directed towards ensuring predictable returns for investors? So far, post-war reconstruction has been characterized by this extension. Actually, they even say this, the terms, the extension of Build Back Better, and green industrial policy and blended finance and political advisory role of foreign finance capital. Ukraine's energy resources like nuclear, wind, solar, gas will be of great benefit to the EU, and they're just saying it openly, you know, because they can replace Russian resources. And with arable land of 33 million hectares, right, Ukraine can replace Russia's supplies of raw materials, critical raw materials to the EU, and become Europe's energy storage hub and electricity provider, literally on the frontier, you know. And this begins with both Ukraine's decommunization of energy, the strong kind of post-Soviet infrastructural and manufacturing capacity in the energy sector, abandoning subsidies for households, eliminating the state's role in the energy sector, and liberalizing the energy market. These are proclaimed as the green transition, you know, and a necessary part of Europeanization. In practice, though, like this winter, Ukrainian households could potentially, you know, the electricity might be limited to only 5 or 7 hours a day, worsening the scenario of energy poverty during the war and after the war. And I will end on this one point, that what we're really seeing is a facilitation of the political advisory role of foreign finance capital in shaping Ukraine's political economic landscape. In November 2022, BlackRock, JP Morgan, and the Ministry of Economy of Ukraine signed a memorandum of understanding, common understanding between them, that BlackRock will provide advisory support for designing an investment framework for Ukraine's reconstruction. They set up what is called Ukraine Development Fund as a reconstruction bank to attract private and public capital for implementing large-scale business projects in Ukraine. It's over 500 million USD in commitments, and over one USD billion commitments in what they call catalytic capital, or investments with, quote, higher risk appetite. That's the language that they use. Okay, it's important to note here that Ukraine's Ministry of Economy appointed BlackRock to advise on the launch of the fund free of charge. Okay, and the five priorities of interest for BlackRock are Ukraine's infrastructure, energy, manufacturing, agriculture, and IT. It'll be based on blended finance, where public money will ensure de-risking for private capital to support this so-called reconstruction of Ukraine. You know, this collaboration, to me, highlights the strategic role BlackRock plays in coordinating investment efforts aimed at rebuilding, so-called rebuilding Ukraine. So I'm going to end. And so ask me again about Ukraine's self-determination. Instead of real self-determination, what we are witnessing, what we're likely to witness, is a structural transformation of another scale, a kind of public sphere and state capacity grabbing by invitation involving new development projects based on public-private partnerships, which ultimately hinder the formulation of politicized alternative progressive strategies, not just for ending the war in Ukraine, but for post-war reconstruction in Ukraine. Thank you.
Wow, thank you for that. So our next and our final speaker is Volodymyr Ischenko, and he was born in Western Ukraine and grew up in Kyiv. He taught sociology at Kyiv University and was active in the Ukrainian New Left. I have to say, he just flew in here last night from Romania and is remarkably not jet-lagged, at least apparently. He's on the editorial board of Commons, as we've mentioned that before, and Left East magazine, as now a researcher at the Institute of East European Studies at the Free University in Berlin. And his writings you've probably seen in many places. I first read your articles in The Guardian, Vladimir, and they've also appeared in Jacobin, New Left Review. And he has a fascinating new piece that I recommend in Unheard, and it's called The Crisis of Soviet Ukraine. He's also the author of the Verso book, Towards the Abyss, Ukraine from Maidan to War. His winning essay for this was published in NLR 138 in November, December 2022, and it's called Ukrainian Voices. And in this piece, Vladimir looks at the narrow nationalism of the Ukrainian elite as a variant of identity politics, which, like its precursors, is eager to curry favor with the EU, but unwilling to challenge the internal Ukrainian or international capitalist status quo. The essay points out the absence or suppression of other voices, especially given the pressing need for Ukrainian society to break free from corruption, from the corruption and crony capitalism of its present social system. Vladimir.
Thank you so much, Susan, for this generous introduction, and many thanks to Daniel Zinger Foundation for the runners-up prize. And I'm very happy to be here. It's really a big honor, and it's indeed very important for me that this essay got recognition, because after publication there was quite extremely hot debate after this, including attacks, violent threats, slander, attempts to deprive me any legitimacy to speak, or even based on my own like 20 years of research and activism in Kyiv. Speak up, okay, yeah, and okay, I'll try to speak slower, and even claiming that I don't have any legitimacy to speak on behalf of my Ukrainian identity. But there was also a lot of praise, which I was very much happy about. Many public, but also many more kind of like private, so we kind of like in the private chats and private conversations, we do love you, what you write, and especially even the Ukrainian Voices essay. and many more messages and emails. And the most gratifying was, of course, the support from the Ukrainian intellectuals who saw that I do speak about something very important in the way how Ukraine is projected in the West, and how, what the role of the Ukrainian intellectual elite in this projection. And I've seen that the essay opened a window, opened some fresh air to raise on the issues that was not possible to speak before. It was very, very difficult to raise the question, who speaks for whom in relation to Ukraine? When we speak about solidarity with Ukraine, solidarity with which exactly part of Ukraine, which exactly classes and groups in Ukraine we are speaking about, and what kind of Ukraine is actually at stake in this war. And I see now that there are more and more Ukrainians who also start to raise these questions. It was very important that the essay was recently translated by a journal who is published both by Russian and Ukrainian historians. And now it kind of like enters from the English-speaking public sphere to Ukraine and Russian public sphere. The journal is published in Moldova, actually, by the relocated Russians and also quite dissenting Ukrainian historians. The essay grew up, obviously, from a quite a long period of accumulated observations and feelings, and my participation in many discussions and given many talks, especially right before the start of the invasion and after the start of the invasion, and reflecting on in which way Ukraine is represented, which way it is projected, when they call to listen to Ukrainian voices, what exactly they look for, and what kind of voices they look for, and what does it mean to be listened, and so on and so forth. But there was also a very specific trigger to start writing that essay. There was another online panel, another group of progressive students or scholars got some money on Ukraine, And they invited to participate in a panel which was literally called Ukrainian Voices or Voices of Ukraine in this way. And I've seen what the list of other speakers is supposed to be, and all of them are coming from the same small elite university in Kyiv. All of them do not... Their first language is Ukrainian and not Russian. And it is still in Ukraine now, after 2.5 years of the full-scale war with Russia, there's still quite a big group of Ukrainians who speak Russian at home with their friends and who prefer to speak this language and who do not switch to Ukrainian language. And, well, half of the speakers come from the exactly the same region in the Western Ukraine. Basically, all of them know each other for 10, 15 years and cooperate with them. And then, and I was looking at this and asking myself, who exactly these people speak for? What kind of Ukraine? What part of Ukraine? How much of Ukraine? And why do they even need to speak in a mediation with some Western university that they can just meet each other in Kyiv? Come on. And on the surface, of course, there's typically good intentions. We want to hear from our country. But at the same time, the reality is that this superficial decolonial attitude, fashionable in the Western academia, creates kind of like exoticized ghetto. And why Ukrainians are not invited to speak about the global problems? The global problems, not only of the war, the global problems of nationalism, of authoritarianism. The previous panel which I listened to was on Red Scares in the United States. It was very informative, from the McCarthyism to what now happens with the mobilizations in support of Palestine, and how supposedly liberals stop being liberals. I mean, that's very familiar in Ukraine. I can tell, I can speak for hours, specific examples. How the people who were claiming to be liberals just forgot about all that liberalism immediately in 2014. And a huge group of Ukrainians became kind of like, almost like subhumans to them. And that kind of like showed that there is kind of like some weird dialectic. The superficial decolonization turns out into something totally the opposite. And I made three arguments in that essay, and I believe that have become only more relevant now. So first of all, that what is called decolonization in the Ukrainian case is fundamentally ethno-nationalist identity politics. It is very different from the kind of decolonization which a big part of the former European colonies experienced since 1950s, 1960s, after the Second World War. It is very different even from the experience of the states who are under foreign aggression, and they start to build stronger mobilizationist states. Especially if that followed social revolutions, and social revolutions typically, as we know from the very extensive scholarship, they built stronger and more capable states to also in order to fight the counter-revolution, both domestically but also abroad. No, this is not what is happening now. And well, there have been some changes from the like almost like cartoonish developments after the start of the full-scale invasion, when they immediately decreased taxes instead of increasing them. When they had projects of privatization instead of nationalization, and so on and so forth. There have been some changes indeed, and currently there is a discussion of increasing taxes in Ukraine. Now, after 2.5 years of the full-scale invasion, only now they start discussing that probably we need to concentrate some resources in the state's hands in order to fight the war. Why this was happening? Well, the West provides a lot of aid. And the main way in which Ukrainian state became stronger is in its capacity to redistribute the Western aid. That's kind of like weird development. And no comparison with the scale of Russian military tensionism. In the book, which has been published by Verso, there is a specific piece on that. And I was among the first people who started to bring this issue to the attention, which actually contributes to Russian resilience in the war. And it's very important. And at the same time, the instability of that Western aid leads to the measures in the economy and the society, foremost the extensive military draft, that are not improving Ukrainian state legitimacy, but on the contrary, are typically perceived as illegitimate extraction of the state by the state and of the state from the society. But on the contrary, the ethno-nationalist transformation of the country has only intensified and accelerated. Well, they stopped teaching Russian language in all, or practically all of the schools in Ukraine. Even in the cities with the overwhelmingly Russian-speaking population like Odessa or Kharkov. Why? Who does it help? Now there are the most recent moves are to ban the biggest church in Ukraine because of the alleged connection to the Russian church. There is evidence of the rising number of everyday conflicts about language. And, well, we know from the 1990s that actually the language issue in the public opinion service was always in the bottom of what was relevant to the people. In the first top places, there were all these prices, unemployment, pensions, corruptions, social economic issues. The questions of EU, NATO language were always in the bottom. And now, and which is quite a very unfortunate development, now more and more people in the same service say the language is now one of the most divisive issues in Ukraine. Why does it even happen during the war? And these developments, this ethno-nationalist decolonization does not add to the legitimacy of the state, does not strengthen the state. It only leads to the contrary, to the alienation of the part of the Ukrainian citizens, to the delegitimation of the state, to the weakening of the state, and to the growing feeling among bigger and bigger number of the people. What is the point to fight for the state at all if it does not see us as as normal human beings who can be publicly represented? The second argument was that this decolonial ethno-nationalist identity politics, despite it sounds kind of like superficial, symbolic, and so on and so forth, it plays actually an important ideological role and serves specific class interests of the Western and also Ukrainian elites. In general, the current rise of identity politics from subaltern groups is a response to the crisis of the ruling class hegemony. You white males, Westerners, do not represent us. You do not speak for us. This is a fundamental push that pushes many groups to claim their identity. What the elites do, they incorporate a narrow elite layer of the subaltern groups in a kind of like tokenized way. This does not challenge the fundamental structures of domination, and the tokenized elite representatives that acquire more opportunities, more representation in the state and economy, they actually do not represent the most fundamental interest of the majorities of the groups with whom they share not that much beyond their identity. In this way, the crisis of hegemony is only reproduced and intensified. And the tokenized incorporation of Ukraine worked in pretty similar manner as an instrument to unite the Western elites and to reclaim the Western legitimacy in fighting the global threat coming from Russia and also from China and also from the kind of like emerging another axis of evil, the threat to democracy and to the rules-based order. The hypocrisy of those claims has become so much apparent after Gaza. Ukrainian professional middle classes and opportunistic elites have been at the same time claiming a niche among the Western elites, presenting themselves as fighting on the frontier, what Elena actually described, frontier of the Western white civilization. But the costs of playing this great role of being on the front against Russia less disproportionately on the Ukrainian subaltern classes, for whom the Ukrainian elites do not speak and whom they do not represent. After the 2.5 years of the war, after the dispersion of Ukrainians across the globe, there are more and more groups of people for whom the Ukrainian elites, Ukrainian state, do not speak at all. They do not speak for the draft dodgers. In the European Union, according to the estimations at the start of this year, and now it's even more, there have been 800,000 of estimated draft dodgers who are not who are supposed to serve in the Ukrainian army but chose not to. Technically, the majority of Ukrainian males between 18 and 60 are also draft dodgers because they did not update their personal data for the military recruitment officers. Despite the many complications and quite serious fines they are going to meet, failing to meet this requirement. The supposed Ukrainian voices do not speak for the Ukrainians in Crimea. How much did you even hear from those people who are in Crimea and who are on the duty actually to be mobilized into the Russian army and now suffer from the regular Ukrainian rocket attacks or drone attacks in Crimea? They do not speak for the Ukrainians in Donbass. They do not speak for the Ukrainians who chose to find a refuge in Russia because they went to their Russian families, Russian relatives. And that could be quite a considerable number, over to 2 million, at least according to the Russian estimations. There is bigger and bigger groups of people who are not represented by the official Ukrainian public sphere. And finally, the final argument, perhaps the most important, that this decolonial, or decolonial in quote marks, ethno-nationalist identity politics not only serves specific elite class interests, but also precludes explaining Ukraine and legitimating Ukraine in a universal way. Because foremost, this identity politics is focused on the erasure of the whole period of the Soviet Ukraine, an erasure of the Soviet Ukrainian experience as a part of the Ukrainian national history. That project was a big dream among the circles of Ukrainian nationalist intelligentsia right from the early 1990s. And they used the start of the full-scale war in order to push forward that project, for which they were dreaming about for decades. They were openly speaking about so-called knife solutions. Now we've got an opportunity. Now we've got an opportunity to finally to transform Ukraine in our image and likeness. And and what it means that the history of Ukrainian participation in the greatest social revolution in the human history is erased. Our grandparents' participation in the defeat of Nazism is diminished, depreciated, delegitimated. Ukrainian contribution to the Soviet art and science are going erased. My family was, in particular, the Soviet scientists who worked on cosmonautics. They worked in the Institute of Cybernetics. That is something that was actually on the edge of the science in 1970s, 1980s. Now it's something, well, it's difficult to be proud for, but you should be proud for this. And in effect, this decolonial identity politics is a reactionary, very reactionary, upside-down vision of the whole 20th century history. The ideological project of the Ukrainian voices, or Ukrainian voices in the quotemarks, is paradoxically depreciating the universal contribution and potential of Ukraine, while presenting the ethno-nationalist regression and comparative project of the peripheral integration to the West that followed the exhaustion of the Soviet Revolution and exhaustion of Soviet modernization as something progressive, which is extremely questionable to the majority of humanity and especially in the global South. So Ukraine, or rather the abyss into which most of the post-Soviet space jumped into, starting from the 1990s and the Russia-Ukraine war is actually a culmination of that process. This is a mirror of the global crisis. The scale of this crisis is becoming more and more apparent with every year. The intensity of this crisis only accelerates, and we see this better and better. We cannot exclude that the crisis tendencies may end in a nuclear apocalypse, also as an escalation of the war which goes on in Ukraine. It can also lead to the disastrous climate change, destroying the conditions for the existence of human civilization. In order to prevent this, we actually need a coordination among the biggest states in the world. But I also believe that it is also possible that the crisis may lead to such a change that would enable a new wave of social revolutions that would continue the task which was not completed by the Soviet Revolution. And now it depends upon Ukrainians. In whatever country we happen to be now, divided by the front line, divided by borders, divided by our beliefs and aspirations, whether we just trying to carve out a little niche for ourselves in the ruins of a collapsing order, or whether we once again are trying to join the forces for the universal social revolutionary movement. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.